Hey guys, it's Brandon from the MacroOps Value Hive podcast. At MacroOps, our aim is simple. We want to make high risk-adjusted returns consistently, continuously learn while doing so, and have a lot of fun along the way. And in this regard, our record speaks for itself. This is partly why we have by far the highest retention rates of any investing service in the industry. Collective members tend to stay members for a long time because there really is nothing else like us. We offer differentiated research, theory, and education resources, plus a killer Slack community filled with some of the smartest operators from around the world. Our members are predominantly professionals, but we also have a high number of highly motivated retail investors and traders. The one thing we all share is a deep love for the game of investing and an unquenchable thirst to get better. If this sounds like you, then consider signing up and checking us out. You simply go to macro-ops.com/collective. That's macro-ops/collective. Before we dive into today's conversation, I want to talk to you about MIT Investment Management Company, also known as MITIMCO, the investment office of MIT. Each year, MITIMCO invests with a handful of new emerging managers who it believes can earn exceptional long-term returns in support of MIT's mission. In order to help the emerging manager community more broadly, they created emergingmanagers.org, a website for emerging manager stock pickers. For those looking to start a stock picking fund or those just looking to learn about how others have done it, I highly recommend this site. You'll find essays and interviews by successful emerging managers, service providers used by MIT's own fund managers, essays MITIMCO has written for emerging stock pickers, and more. MITIMCO also occasionally and opportunistically hires new members for their investment team. To view the job description, please visit mitimco.org/global-investor. That's mitimco.org/global-investor. The MITIMCO team spends their time learning about great businesses and investments, working with exceptional investors around the world in order to support generations of MIT innovators. This episode of Value Hive is brought to you by Tegas. If you enjoy listening to Value Hive, you'll love the Tegas product. Tegas has the world's largest collection of instantly available expert interviews on all the public and private companies that you care about. All you have to do is log in. So if you're tired of high-cost and time-consuming expert research calls, give Tegas a try and see for yourself why many of the most trusted and well-respected hedge funds, mutual funds, family offices, allocators, and VCs rely on Tegas to scale their expert research and to get the critical information they need faster than ever. You can sign up for a free trial at tegas.co/valuehive. That's tegas.co/valuehive. And as a personal anecdote, I use Tegas literally every single day. It's the first resource I use when I start researching a new investment, and it's one of the last things I do before I finish up rounding out my research, and I know you'll love it as much as I do. Rebecca Hunter, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. This is going to be an interesting discussion on uranium exploration and maybe just mining exploration in general. And so, as a brief background, you are, you know, for those listening that maybe don't know you or follow you on Twitter, you're the VP of Exploration at Forum Energy. And just before we dive in, I don't own any Forum Energy. This isn't going to be a Forum Energy pitch. All this is just kind of in basically education and informational stuff. So nothing to do with Forum as a company or as an investment idea, but a lot to do with exploration, a lot to do with geology, a lot to do with uranium. So walk our listeners through how you got started in geology and exploration and how you ended up at Forum.
Thanks a lot, Brandon. Thanks a lot for having me. So the story, well, I mean, I'm Saskatchewan born and raised. Very familiar with uranium because it's a big part of Saskatchewan and what we produce, as well as potash. So that was always a big part of, like, people in my community worked in those mines. So there was always that type of familiarity. But I didn't really know any of that when I started. But I went into earth science and fell in love with basically the earth and time, that sort of stuff, learning about mineral deposits and just how that benefits society. So that's kind of where, I started. I did an undergrad in Saskatoon. Then I did a master's. I still wanted to learn more. I wasn't quite happy with that. So I did a master's in Regina. Did a lot of bedrock mapping. So a lot of what very grassroots sort of geology, where you're in a field, a little dome tent for 3 months, essentially. It hardens you quite a bit, for this type of work. And then I started with Cameco. So I was lucky enough to get a job with Cameco, you know, a great company, and basically worked in their exploration department for another, you know, almost 12 years and kind of went up through the ranks in that organization until everything kind of went down, you know, post Fukushima, things got really tough. And so in that time, the project that I was running, so when I was at Cameco, one of the things that I was really lucky to be able to do is that I basically got given the Thelon project. So one of their kind of very grassroots exploration projects up in the Nunavut territory. And so I had the opportunity to take that project from a very, you know, basically moose pasture. Nothing is there. You just got a big land package. You got to find deposits from tons, you know, there's like 200,000 hectares of land or something like that. And then basically try to find deposits in there. So that was kind of, and so I had that really great opportunity to take it from, you know, just getting out, looking at the rock, sampling, to, you know, looking at, you know, doing lots of geophysics over the area, which I can talk about more. And then basically honing into deposits. And we did. And the team that I had was amazing at the time. And we were just a really good group of nerds, essentially, that really wanted to find uranium. So, and we did. But then, of course, Fukushima happened. You know, the Nunavut territory is a little bit more remote to work than the Athabasca. So, you know, Cameco kind of pulled away from that area after Fukushima. So then I wasn't quite happy with that. So I started a PhD. So I took that data that was we generated in that project and basically did a PhD to basically understand the area even better. Because again, just really want, you know, passionate about finding deposits, wanted to find more up there. Everything was cut too short too soon, and so wanted to basically help that process. Did a PhD in that, kind of did a little bit of junior. I left Cameco, did a bit of junior exploration, went back to the government for a little bit to again learn about other types of deposits, copper and precious metal and stuff like that, work in BC, and then basically Forum staked the old ground that Cameco had, and that's kind of how it came full circle. So Rick staked that Cameco. We did, I spent about $50 million of their dollars when we worked up there in Nunavut, and Rick got in there, the CEO of Forum, staked it for $150,000 and basically asked if I wanted to restart this, and I did. So, and that's kind of how I ended up back in Forum, back in Nunavut, back exploring.
That's a really cool kind of circle of life from a career perspective, starting at one location, seeing it wind down, and then coming back to it in a new light. I'm so fascinated by that Fukushima time period where the entire industry just blew up, basically. Walk me through how that was and kind of how that felt from your perspective. I mean, you were literally, you know, boots on the ground trying to find this stuff, and then Fukushima happens and capital dries up.
Yeah, so it was kind of funny because it happened, and actually, you know, our group at Cameco, like, it was all very much downplayed. It was like, oh no, this is okay, because everything was ticking up. Like, you know, we had the big spike where everything kind of went up in 07, then the 08 crash, and that kind of knocked us down, but not really, not too much. We still, like, the big companies still plugged ahead. And then, yeah, Fukushima happened. Things were starting to look up. I remember the Cameco stock price just before it happened was ticking up, and there was a pretty nice buzz in the office because everyone's mood is very much kind of focuses around the stock price for our type of work. Fukushima happened. And it was kind of downplayed. It was like, oh, this is going to blow over. This is going to blow over. This is not a big deal. And we kind of kept going a bit, and then yeah, then it was just a slow downfall because it wasn't going away. Because yeah, the Japan, kind of stopped a lot of their reactors, started stockpiling, and then it kind of had that cascade effect throughout the world, where other countries started saying that they wanted to move away from nuclear, and it kind of gave the anti-nuclear sentiment that a bit of a lift, and they really rode that. So I guess, long story short, at the beginning it was like, no, this is okay, and then it was like, not okay. And yeah, lots of cuts, big layoffs, and yeah, very kind of a dark period for us poor people in the uranium world.
Yeah. And you said at one point you were spending, or you spent, what was it, $50 million in exploration, and you were, kind of had a hand in that. How do you decide how much to allocate to where, and what are those allocation buckets? Is it, hey, 10 million for drilling, 5 million for geoservices, and how does that relate to uranium specifically versus other maybe metals or commodities?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it probably actually doesn't, it's not, it's probably all the same across the different commodities for the most part. But essentially, when you start a new type of project, the kind of the first pass work is to just get on the ground. And basically, if you have what we call outcrop, or exposed bedrock, you start looking at that, sampling that, measuring it. You do a number of till. You can do till, like in our area of the world, the areas Canada's been affected by glaciers, so you can use kind of glacial till, sample that for, basically look for uranium in that till, in the case of uranium, or elements that are associated with uranium. All that's very cheap, so that sort of work, is tens of thousands of dollars, tens to maybe $50,000 to kind of do that type of work. And then geophysics, so that's, when we use kind of methods to basically image underneath the earth. So, and there's a variety of different ones. Electromagnetics measures, things that are conductive within, underneath, in the subsurface. Magnetics, radiometrics is ones where you actually see areas of radioactivity on the surface. Those all cost more, so it depends. So then those are hundreds of thousands of dollars to start doing that, and that's, but you need to do that type of work to basically narrow in, because drilling is what costs the most. And so one of my drill, like a 250 meter drill hole in the Thelon, is going to cost you $30,000 or more. So that's where the big money is, but you can only test a very, very small area. The core is only, a few inches across. And so you use all these other types of methods to kind of hone you in, so that you're not spending that big money right off the bat and testing, well, just testing not good targets. So yeah, the 50 million that I would have spent, largely went into drilling. So the first 3 years, we did a lot of that groundwork and a lot of that geophysics, and that would have costed, probably 10 million. But a good 40 million of that, at least 30 million, went into the ground via drilling sort of stuff, and all the costs associated with that. So, up there you use a helicopter, you have to build a camp and stuff like that, and pay people, and all the sort of everything that surrounds that work.
Yeah, that actually leads right into my next question, which is like the remoteness of certain locations and the infrastructure needed to make something feasible. And I think like one consensus is that at a higher commodity price, there's all of these projects that become feasible, but with the caveat of you need the necessary infrastructure, the roads, the bridges, and things to get ore in and out, and to get big, heavy trucks in and out. When you have spent, all of your time spent doing these drilling exercises and doing these explorations, How simple is it to, you know, turn the lights on from an infrastructure perspective, to go from, let's say, barren land to, oh, like, let's build some roads and let's make this thing viable? Like, how, and then how has that changed over time? Has it gotten easier, more complicated?
Yeah, well, I mean, infrastructure helps. It helps the whole process, even before, long before you get to a mining stage, just because of access. And that's in the case of, you know, the two districts that I know the best, which is the Athabasca and the Thelon being where I'm working now. Yeah, like the Thelon doesn't have that infrastructure. There's no roads to site, but the Athabasca has. So just that ability to get in and get working. Yeah, because otherwise in these areas where you don't have that, you've got to rely on, you know, airplanes or helicopters to get in, which just adds a cost. But, you know, a lot of it that we try to promote is that in areas that have less infrastructure, the best way to explore them is just to have more scale. And so, you know, the more that you can test, the more you can get in there, you know, more drilling, you know, more work, it actually brings that cost down. So, you know, doing really small programs where there's roads, it can be the very similar cost than doing a larger project where there is no road. So you can mitigate that. And I guess you just have to choose what's the prize. And if the prize is big enough, then the cost to get there is actually very insignificant. You know, all the infrastructure problems can be overcome if the prize is big enough. So yeah, and in, you know, remote areas, and that is exactly what happened with Agnico. So Agnico Eagle has two big operations, and they're working on a potential third in Nunavut, which has, you know, no infrastructure. They had to build the road, you know. As far as power and stuff, I mean, you get big diesel generators, or hopefully what I would like in the future is they have little SMRs to power their sites. And then it's all the same. You just have the materials and you build your mine, you build your development.
One theory that I've had this year, and really since the end of last year, is inflation will be higher for longer. And if you look at a lot of the cost curves, the cost structures for mining companies, whether it's exploration or producers, you're seeing an increase in really every single line item. And whether it's equipment, whether it's labor, just, you know, environmental regulations, red tape, when you go to explore and from your seat at Forum, does that theory corroborate with what you're seeing actually on the ground, where like you get a quote for a driller and it's maybe 10, 15, 20% higher than it was even a year or two ago?
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah. The costs have definitely gone up. Supply. I mean, at least the one thing that's kind of eased off, which is great, is the supply chain issues. As far as, like, you know, a couple of years ago, even getting steel and stuff like that, like, at least that's eased off. But yeah, as far as, yeah, the prices have gone up, personnel. But yeah, I mean, it's across the board. So, you know, mining, everything, groceries.
and so when you look at those costs, and you go to, let's say, budget for the next year or two of exploration, like, how does that impact your budgeting process and the assumptions you make?
Yeah, you add that percentage, you know, and I mean, some things are, you know, kind of the same, but yeah, I mean, we just have to increase that amount of money for sure. But it's not terrible. Like, it's, you know, a lot of it still, like the helicopters, you know, I'm paying, you know, $2,200, you know, an hour. And, you know, even back in the last cycle, you know, when things were crazy and things were busy, you know, you were getting charged, you know, $1,800, sometimes $2,002, depending on the level of flying you were doing. So, so things, you know, it's higher, but it's definitely doable.
Yeah. Well, I guess when uranium prices quadruple in a year, it makes a lot of things more attainable. Walk me through your process and kind of your game plan for the next 18 to 24 months, knowing what has happened in uranium prices, and how does that affect how you plan for exploration, for budgeting, for how much money you spend on drilling, and like, what are the assumptions you make for long-term uranium prices?
Well, I mean, I'm always thinking about discovery and getting the most value for the shareholders. So I like getting as much of that money into the ground, but I also like to do it smart. And so, a lot of times, a lot of companies kind of get into this kind of terrible cycle of drilling too soon. And because, of course, you know, for a company, you know, the real discovery that you're going to make is going to be with, obviously drilling it. And sometimes you don't do that background work enough. You kind of rush to get those results because the shareholders, you know, want the results. You obviously want the results, but you don't drill the best targets. And so my strategy always, even when the uranium price is hopping like this, is that you still need to spend that time to do the right surveys. In a lot of cases, you know, like for uranium, geophysical surveys are very key, because you can't, for the most part, you can't actually see the rocks. Like in a lot of gold or copper, you can get on the ground and you can sample stuff. And I mean, they use a lot of geophysics as well, but in some ways you actually can see the rocks better and hone in without as much geophysics. For uranium, most of these deposits are blind. And so you need to be using, you know, good surveys and kind of get quite a few layers of good surveys, have good geos and geophysicists looking at that data so that when you do drill and you're ready to spend that money, which of course, like you said, and we know everything's gone up in price, you want to get the most bang for your buck and then also get into a place where those drill holes are actually telling you exactly where you need to be. They could be saying, yeah, no, this is area's garbage, or it's telling you that, no, this is an area you need to chase. You want those answers and you want to, you know, use your money effectively to get there. So that's kind of my strategy. So you do need to front load a bit with that kind of technical work so that you have the most success once the drilling stage comes.
So for those companies that rush or try to get to drilling too quickly, what's that timeline like? Is it, you know, hey, anything, if they start drilling within 12 months of, let's say, discovery or something like that, that's too early? Or is it, you know, hey, I want to see a company, an exploration company, do at least 18 to 24 months of geophysical work before drilling, as like a red flag, kind of green flag scenario?
Yeah, no, I think that's it. You need a couple years to kind of do those surveys, get that understanding it before you drill. So yeah, I mean, if you're drilling, you get a property and you're drilling, you know, boom, within, you know, 6 months, it's like, okay, but are you ready? And you'd have to look at their work too and say, hey, you know, this project has had a lot of work done on it already. You know, it has those targets that are, yeah, it's obvious, start drilling right away. But if it's a very new project, and or even an old project that maybe hasn't had the best work done on it in the past, yeah, you need a few years. So yeah, I like to see that. But I mean, again, shareholders are like, we need news, we need, you know, we want results, you know, like, what are you doing? You know, geophysics isn't, you don't find a deposit with just geophysics. So yeah, you've got to balance it. But I think, yeah, the junior world would be better served by just having a little bit more patience that's one of the real benefits of the senior companies, is that they do, and that's kind of what I learned through Cameco, is that more methodical approach to exploration. But you know, they have the cash flow, so right, they're not beholden to have to raise this money. So I get it. I'm certainly not criticizing how it's done in the junior world, because I get it. But I think if we can try to do a bit more front loading, it would serve the whole industry better, for sure.
And when it comes to the actual drilling and then the interpretation of the results, What is a good result? What is a poor result? And how can you distinguish between, like, maybe some of the nuances of not like games that certain companies play, but, you know, if we're being honest, like, you know, a very small microcap uranium explorer co is going to do everything they can to promote their discovery. And so, you know, they will spin it any way they can. And like, I know with copper, for instance, if you have a high grade, let's say like 2 to 3% grade at depth, like, yeah, that's a great drill result. What is that equivalent in uranium?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question, but that's a big question.
Yeah.
So, one thing you'd want to look for. I mean, when I first started, like, I would find the most minute little thing. So we're just honing into stuff, and there'd be a little, you know, very tiny bit of alteration, which, you know, in uranium deposits, they typically are surrounded by these types, the unconformity types. They're associated with clay. And so they have a lot of clay associated with them. And I'd find like a little fracture, essentially, a little seam of clay. And I'd be like, you know, all excited because, you know, this might be honing us into, you know, something bigger or whatever. So, right. So you do, and geologists, unfortunately, we're always pretty enthusiastic and half glass or glass half full sort of people. So we do look for subtle things, and we will, you know, because sometimes those things do hone you in. And my early discovery, we had the first hole actually that we drilled on the Thelon project was basically less than 100 meters away from the mineralization that we know now. So it's crazy that was our first hole. And it wasn't that exciting of a hole, but it had some of those really subtle things where it had some of that really subtle alteration. Didn't have any radioactivity. Like, it wasn't like, yeah, there's something going on. It was just, it had some of these other characteristics that kind of tell you that fluids moved in the area and stuff like that. And so it was like, well, that's good. You know, this area, we should be followed up, but it was subtle. And so sometimes you do promote the subtle things. So the subtle things can be very close to these deposits and not know. So there's a bit of that, but once you're in kind of the zones, like, you know, what you want to look for in uranium is that alteration. Like, are they, you know, talking about that type of alteration that can hone you in? Like, if there's not much, but they're kind of talking about, you know, like these types of the structures or the alteration is kind of favorable. Like, those are kind of interesting things, and they can hone you in. Grade, you know, if they're talking about, you know, if you're thinking about stuff to go down the road, like, is this area actually going to be interesting? Mm-hmm. You want to listen in those press releases for the actual grade. And so, you know, any grades over 0.5%, over 1% in particular, are really good for unconformity type deposits. But then you want to know, how thick is it? So, you know, when they give you those intercepts, if it's, you know, it's like 1% over 10 centimeters, well, that's not as interesting, of course, as, you know, 1% over, you know, 5 meters.
Yeah.
You know, so you kind of look at that, and you think about mining as well. So you think about, you know, depth to when you're actually, you know, listening to these press releases, because if they're really shallow, you know, that improves the economics. So, you know, if it's under 300 meters, you know, 250 meters, then those types of zones, if it's economic in the end, can be extracted via an open pit, which is a lot cheaper than underground mining. And so, you know, if you see a press release and you got, you know, 1% over 3 meters, and it's, you know, under 200 meters versus, you know, another project that might have higher grades, but the mineralization's at 400, 500 or plus meters, then you look at that and it's like, okay, well, that's all really good, but holy cow, that's going to be an underground development. And maybe that's not going to see the light of day, at least with our foreseeable regulation or mining methods for a very long time unless it's big enough. And so you kind of have to grade, you kind of have to think about grade and depth and kind of where it is when you're evaluating kind of which companies you think have the goods, I guess.
That was, yeah, that was a great explanation. I feel like, I mean, not only just for uranium, but for any kind of mine. And that's one of the things, again, like this idea that all the easy copper, all the easy uranium, all the easy commodities have been mined already. And what's left is lower grade, a little bit more expensive, and a little bit more complex to get. And part of that is this difference between the open pit mine and the underground. And I think open pit's very easy for people to understand because you can just Google open pit and you can see, like, just it's literally just a giant hole in the ground with, you know, some kind of steps around for the heavy equipment to get down. But walk me through the underground mine and the difference in terms of cost and just complexity for an underground mine versus, let's just say, an open pit.
Yeah, so I mean, yeah, an open pit, like you said, is easy to scoop it out. If you find it, you scoop it out. And I guess, yeah, even that has some complexity too, because you want to make sure that your deposit is big enough. If it's very thin, an open pit is not the greatest option either, because you have to think about your stripping ratio versus your actual, you know, ore. So there is considerations there. But yeah, an underground mine, so you need to basically move a lot of earth, or you need to go into the earth. And so I remember back, and this was again in the last cycle, when they were sinking the Cigar Lake shaft to
extract. So what does that mean again? And I'm sorry, I might interrupt because this is very technical language and I want to make sure that I understand this. So when you say sinking a shaft, what does that mean?
So they're basically drilling, you know, that initial hole, that which is usually quite big for ventilation and to bring, you know, put the basically the lift in to bring, you know, people down and also to bring ore up. And so basically, yes, sinking the shaft is that initial, you know, digging into the ground at depth. And then basically you get down whatever you're doing and then you move out from that in what we call drifts. So, and then two towards the ore body extracted, et cetera. And there's different methods on exactly how that's done underground, which I'm not an expert. So I just put that caveat out there. I've been in a few mines and certainly not a mine geologist, but just in the simplest of terms, you go and you extract and there's different ways depending on the rock that you're mining into. But yeah, sinking a shaft is that initial big tunnel, essentially vertical shaft that you drill down. And that shaft was, I think it was $1 million a meter to
oh my gosh.
So these aren't, yeah. So they're not, you know, small endeavors, and you need to do two because, one, you need that ventilation. So you always have at least two shafts. So you have the inflow and outflow of ventilation, which is important. Very much important in uranium mines, because if you're actually interacting with the radioactive ore, then you need to have that ventilation so that all the, you know, radon and dust is moved out. So yeah, so expensive. and then how, depending on how deep you go, again, it gets more expensive. And then, you know, and all the workings underground, you just think about it, all the electricity, all the, if you have any milling under there or whatnot. And so anyways, yes, underground mines are a whole different ball of wax.
And do you think going forward, and again, like, I'm going to ask a lot of big questions, not expecting you to know, you know, the answers to any specificity, but if we play this uranium market out, let's say another 3 to 5 years, prices hang around, let's call it like $70 to $100 a pound. Will we see more underground mines or more open pit mines? And is that a function of just how much uranium is available at certain price points, basically?
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly things that are closer to surface, like you should start seeing companies, seeing that that price point being ideal, to start those type of operations. So anything that's open pittable, anything, that's extractable near surface. So I wouldn't be surprised if we hear more from, companies working in those districts, stuff that's been shuttered for quite a while with the low prices. With the underground mines, I think it's still, I mean, we recently McClean Lake is opening again. So that's good. So, some of these more like a little bit deeper zones might be extracted. But we'll see. I think you're still going to need, like, based on the inflation, whatnot. Like, I remember back in the last cycle, $60, they were like, yeah, we could go ahead with stuff with the $60 per pound price. But now I don't think so. And so, you're probably looking at that 100, plus to make it sustainable.
Yeah.
So, but don't quote, like, not like we'll
Yeah,
see
of
what these
course.
companies do. They know their economics. Things
Yeah.
are changing too. So, Denison, is working towards kind of doing that kind of in situ recovery kind of method, but with the unconformity deposits. And so, that could be a big game changer too, because then you don't need to do that underground development to the same extent. You're just basically injecting, just like in Kazakhstan, like those kind of in situ recovery operations in Kazakhstan or the US, where you just inject wells that then percolate to the ground, basically put the uranium in solution and pump it up. So you don't actually have that mine. You just have the, it's more of a fluid thing. So they're trying a very similar kind of system in the Athabasca Basin. So we'll see where that goes. Because that also, if that works, then, a lot of these deposits that are at, deeper than open pittable, then maybe could be extracted in a much more cost-effective way.
And I think this all, kind of culminates with this big supply demand imbalance that we're seeing in uranium. And it's one of the reasons why I have you on, is just, there's this gap between the demand that you see from either new reactors being built, existing reactors extending lifetimes, and just a general bullish sense on nuclear again for the first time since, kind of pre-Fukushima. And so my question is, someone that basically owns Sprott Uranium ETF, like I'm long Sprott U, and obviously a wider supply demand imbalance is bullish for the underlying and would be bullish for bullish for any uranium stocks. How realistic or feasible is it for new supply to come online in a capacity that would do a dent to the existing imbalance?
Yeah, well, I guess it all depends. I mean, if the price is high enough, I mean, that then stuff just becomes very economic. And I mean, stuff is like a lot, like all the deposits in the Athabasca, I think, would be economic at $100 uranium price. It's just for new developments, you have that CapEx, that big capital expense to bring it online. And then all the permitting and all that sort of thing, everything, it's a very rigorous process when it comes to uranium mines. But I mean, if the demand, the thing is, the demand is just going to be so crazy if we go in this trajectory. And if the price reflects that, then I think you have to, because how else are you going to get the power that we need? And so, yeah, I mean, it does take a while though. So I mean, like MacArthur was probably the fastest uranium mine to go from discovery to production in the Athabasca Basin for
How
those
long
types.
was that?
It took about 10 years. And
That
that
is
was,
quick. That is
yeah,
quick.
and so and it was, but it was a incredible deposit. So it was like, the right time in history. It was an incredible, like high grade deposit, and it happened. But yeah, so it was discovered in, I think, in 88, and was started production in the late 90s there. So It can happen. You know, I think where there's a will, there's a way. So we'll see. I hope so, because I mean, we need a lot of uranium going forward. So especially if we bring on, you know, not just the reactors that are kind of projected and slated now, but, you know, going forward. And then if SMRs aren't really even calculated in that demand.
And part of that demand side argument is the, you know, overfeeding, underfeeding, and enriching dynamic. And how is that, you know, kind of segment of the demand market different or similar than kind of pre-Fukushima? And how significant will that demand driver be going forward, whether it's, you know, overfeeding, underfeeding, or just kind of the flip in that dynamic?
You know, I think the biggest thing is that stockpile that, you know, basically was created after Fukushima, because all those reactor shutdowns, basically that the era of that stockpiling is over. And so that's what's really changed the dynamic in basically us realizing like how much we actually need, and then putting, you know, thinking about all the reactors that are needed, you know, if we want to, you know, get net zero and all this sort of stuff, just the sort of requirements that are needed for that. So I think that's what's really changed in this market now. So yeah.
And going back to the exploration company life cycle, you know, everyone talks about the Lassonde curve and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
When you're inside an exploration company and you're thinking about, you know, not only exploration and drilling, but just the evolution of where do we want this business to be? What's our exit strategy? Like what's kind of the final plan? Walk me through that process on that decision of like, okay, do we want to drill enough to then just get bought? Do we want to drill enough and maybe we can become a producing company? And I guess all of that's kind of a function of scale and scope of the project.
Yeah. So it depends on kind of what happens and kind of what the market does as well. Like when people make discoveries and the market is all hot and crazy, then, you know, people tend to get bought out. There's this franticness, which, you know, happened in the last cycle with like Hathor and stuff like that. But then you get into a bear market if you find something, and then that franticness goes, and then some of the companies then, you know, have to pivot towards maybe developing their resource. So my expertise is not mining. it's exploration. So I mean, regardless of where the company might go, you know, like if you find something and you get to that stage where, you know, it needs to be taken in that more development direction, you would either, yeah, sell it if that is the way it happened. But it all depends on what's the best for your shareholders. And so if it's best to then, you know, kind of get a different management in, get different expertise and take it from there. Yeah, it would depend exactly where you are and what you know.
And so if you do decide to sell it, one of the kind of not black box, but it's probably one of the most difficult things to do is value an exploration company and just kind of think like, what's this thing worth? You kind of have to do like an options value. But
yep,
when you're inside the business, when you're focused on exploration, if you were to kind of flip seats and be in the investor seat, what would you want to see from an exploration company? And then how would you value these explorcos, whether it's uranium, whether it's copper or anything?
Yeah, well, I think you want to, first of all, you kind of look at where they're at as far as their share price. And so, you know, looking at those, you know, people that you could see that are undervalued, that are, you know, the penny stocks, you kind of look at that first and kind of see, and then you kind of delve into them in general. And see what they're doing with that, with their projects. Like, what type of projects do they have? You know, are they, you know, are they doing good work essentially? And I guess by good work is, yeah, like you could see that they're taking a nice methodical approach. They're, you know, they're thinking about the geology. You can get a feel that the people within their company actually kind of care and are trying to do that work that can lead to discovery. That's what I look for, you know, and I try to live by, I guess, is, you know, like there is, you mentioned it earlier in the podcast that, you know, there's this sentiment that deposits are getting deeper, they're harder to find, you know, and in some ways, I think that's not exactly true. In a lot of ways, sometimes there's just not a lot of good work has been done. Money pushed into districts doesn't necessarily equate to good work. And so like when you actually delve and if you're looking at an area and you go through the historical work, you look and a lot of the holes might have been chasing a different model, so they might not have been drilling deep enough. They might not have, you know, done the right work. You know, a lot of, you got to kind of keep up with the times. Like geophysics is a great example. It's very much evolved over the years, like what we can do mathematically to image. So you got to kind of keep up with the times and kind of push that boundary. So that's what I look for, is companies that are kind of pushing the boundary, that are doing really good geological work. And I think success, you know, comes with that type of work.
So then if you were going to like put a price or try to, again, like value like two Explorer Co's, you know, company A and company B, would it be, you know, market cap to indicated reserves, or, you know, measured and indicated, or would it be, you know, a price to even maybe like a land package or something where they haven't even drilled yet, they just have this land package? Like I'm trying to just determine relative valuation and maybe figuring some KPIs to help me do that.
Yeah, I mean, I would look at, yeah, their land package. You know, land packages by, it's a bit lame, I guess, but land packages by some of the major companies usually is pretty good, because, you know, it's the right district. It's the, you know, it's basically the bigger companies like Cameco. In the case of the Athabasca, you know, Cameco, Orano, Denison, you know, these companies have been around a long time, and they have, you know, some pretty prime real estate, let's say. And so, you know, again, making sure that your company that you're following is kind of, maybe not like, it doesn't have to be right beside, but it has to be in the right corridors, because you gotta be in the right area to find these deposits. So, you know, you can get lots of land. You can look at these companies with lots of land and stuff like that, but where is it? You know, if it's on the margins, and it's, you know, it's like, okay, it's land, but what is it? So, I mean, that's kind of how I evaluate that. And I mean, I'm technical, so I can look at the area and be like, hey, that's the right geology. So that's where you want to be. But if you're just an investor, you're not going to have that knowledge, but, you know, kind of following along where some of these majors are, that's usually a good key. Good management, you know, like, again, like good technical people with the success in the past, that's always a good way to value. And people that are, you know, pushing the envelope, new districts, like what we're like in the forum, we're trying to push the Thelon, because I just feel it's completely underexplored. And there's areas of similar, you know, it's very similar in the Athabasca that are underexplored. Like it was people like Fission and the predecessors of all that and NextGen that found those great deposits in the Western Athabasca, and they weren't listening to the majors. The majors were kind of like, yeah, that area is crap. And they went in there and they looked at the geology and proved otherwise. So you're kind of recognizing that in a company. It'd be kind of tough without kind of getting in the face of some of the people that are actually doing the work, but that's some of the things anyway.
I want to discuss labor and talent in the industry, which I think, again, if we look at supply demand imbalances, I think labor and skilled talent in mining has the chance to become significant, where there's much more demand than available supply. And a lot of that's just because it's not pushed in colleges. And since mm-hmm. it's not pushed, there's no programs because there's no money there, because there's, you know, maybe one or two students. So when you look at your exploration team, or just the history of working at Cameco until now, how have you seen the labor market evolve or devolve over time?
Yeah, it's tricky. Yeah, because earth science isn't where a lot of people want to end up, or it's not promoted. I think mining, you know, is like, you know, it's promoted more as this dirty sort of industry, and it doesn't promote as much people to enter it. And so I think in general, the geological and kind of mining industry needs to work on that image so that we bring more people in. So that, because yeah, there's definitely a shortage. And then of course the up and downs of this industry, it's not, you know, it's not a just a nice stable industry. It's, and so you lose people in those times as well. Like you train people for 10 years and then you have a downturn and then you lose those people. And then you get these kind of clusters where you have lots of people at certain age groups and then nobody. So yeah. Going forward, I think it's a bigger advocacy thing that needs to be done to promote mining in general and people and women into mining as well as much as we can. It's improved, you know, it's improving all the time, but it's still, yeah, it's not where it needs to be. But I mean, we get enough people and you coach them. Like for me, you know, just keen people that want to be outside, that kind of have that passion for this type of work, you can build and mentor people into great, great people that can find the next generation of deposits.
Yeah, that's a great answer. And kind of leads me into kind of the last question I have, which is a little bit different, but I'm interested in like a day in the life of what you do, especially since, you know, it's outside in these remote places and, you know, you're basically digging up the earth to see if you can find some, you know, some uranium. And so walk me through that day to day, you know, starting, you know, like when you wake up at a, you know, normal day at a mine site camp or at an exploration camp and that whole process.
Yeah, well, I've been lucky that I've had, you know, many different experiences. But if you're going to do the exploration, I mean, you get up, you know, you stay in a little tent. Usually it's like a 4-person tent, so you're sharing, you know. It could be still snow on the ground, depending on what time of year. Or, like, I've mostly done kind of summer work. So be still in the Thelon, there still be snow. You go into your little, you know, kitchens that you have, you know, kind of a camp kitchen sort of thing. And then you do your thing there, get fed, and then you get out in the field. So it's all, for me, it was always helicopter. So it's like, get out to the helicopter, you know, fly to your site. And then you're out in the beginning. When I first started, sometimes you're out on your own, actually. You didn't even have, you're just kind of had radio contact with, you know, a crew that might be a kilometer away, but you're out on your own with your little clipboard. And in this case of uranium, you have basically a scintillometer, we call it, but if people don't know what that is, it's like a Geiger counter, measures radioactivity. And you just walk the ground and try not to get chased by wolverines, or, you know, might see the odd odd caribou. and you just enjoy. I mean, it's beautiful out there, and you get to think about the rocks and wander the ground, and yeah, it's where I'd like to be. But now, I mean, nowadays you want to walk through my life. Now it's more on the computer, looking at invoices and figuring out the program for next year.
Yeah. I mean, being out in nature, it sounds like that's a, you know, could be a super relaxing, peaceful, cathartic experience when you're just walking around trying to find some good rock and, you know, out there in the Canadian wilderness.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And you know, I'm glad that we had this conversation, because it's always fun to interview people that are doing the actual work, that aren't just kind of looking at it from an investor's perspective, but are walking the ground, are finding the rock, or drilling the holes, because I gain insights that I wouldn't otherwise know just by reading company presentations or 10Ks or things like that. So I greatly appreciate, you know, you taking an hour to spend answering all my questions. Some of them are probably very elementary to you. So
no.
I appreciate that.
It was all very good. It was great questions.
I've got two closing questions for you, which okay. I ask every guest. The first one is, where can people go to find out more about you? We connected on Twitter, obviously. Yeah. So, you know, if anybody wants to reach out to you there, what's the handle?
It's at Uranium Huntress, which I think is clever and fun.
I'm actually shocked that that wasn't taken, because that's a pretty cool handle. Okay, cool. So at Uranium Huntress. And then the final question, if you could have dinner with anyone from the past or the present, who would it be and why?
Oh my goodness. There's so many that I'd love to have dinner with, but I'm a big Mark Twain fan, like as far as like his wit, and I think he would be an amazing person to just know, in general. And he has a perspective from the past that's quite interesting. So anyway, but there's so many, and there's women, and yeah, I don't have to, I didn't get to think about that. And geologists, there's geologists that I'd love to know. Some of those early pioneers in geology, you know, so Wilson, who basically came up with the plate tectonics and whatever. Anyways.
Kind of makes you wonder how these people found a bunch of rock before geophysics and everything. Like the way I think about it is, like, how would I get anywhere without my GPS? Is the same way. It's like, how would we mine anything without geophysics and all this underground technology we have now?
Yeah, no, we've come a long way. And but those people from the past, they were clicked in. They knew how to find stuff too. So
I guess they had higher grades, which made up for it.
Grades, and they probably weren't distracted so much with all the, you know, emails and all the other stuff that were.
Today's episode is also brought to you by Marhelm Data. Marhelm is an information service for investors to find real value in an overvalued market. With a focus on shipping and commodities, Marhelm helps you stay on the pulse of global trade, track global sentiment, and identify compelling global investment opportunities. ValueHive listeners can get 20% off a Marhelm Data subscription by using the code VALUE at checkout. That's VALUE at checkout. Head on over to marhelm.com, marhelm.com, to get your discount today.